perused at length by a large team. Today's job was a preliminary overview. Van Damme's truck was a mess. The Germans had begun to destroy their papers when they realized the battle was lost. Boxes had been emptied, and a small fire started, but the damage had been arrested quickly. There was blood on a cardboard folder. Someone had died defending his secrets. Van Damme went to work. They would have tried to destroy the important papers first, so he began with the half-burned pile. There were many Allied radio signals, intercepted and in some cases decoded. Most of it was routine. Most of everything was routine. But as he worked, Van Damme began to realize that German intelligence's wireless interception was picking up an awful lot of useful information. They were better than Van Damme had imagined, and Allied wireless security was very bad. At the bottom of the half-burned pile was a book, a novel in English. Van Damme frowned. He opened the book and read the first line. "Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again." The book was called Rebecca, and it was by Daphne du Maurier. The title was vaguely familiar. Van Damme thought his wife might have read it. It seemed to be about a young woman living in an English country house. Van Damme scratched his head. It was, to say the least, peculiar reading for the Afrika Korps. And why was it in English? It might have been taken from a captured English soldier, but Van Damme thought that unlikely. In his experience, soldiers read pornography, hard-boiled private eye stories, and the Bible. Somehow, he could not imagine the desert rats getting interested in the problems of the mistress of Manderley. No, the book was here for a purpose. What purpose? Van Damme could think of only one possibility. It was the basis of a code. A book code was a variation on the one-time pad. A one-time pad had letters and numbers randomly printed in 5-character groups. Only 2 copies of each pad were made, one for the sender and one for the recipient of the signals. Each sheet of the pad was used for one message, then torn off and destroyed. Because each sheet was used only once, the code could not be broken. A book code used the pages of a printed book in the same way, except that the sheets were not necessarily destroyed after use. There was one big advantage which a book had over a pad. A pad was unmistakably for the purpose of encipherment, but a book looked quite innocent. In the battlefield, this did not matter, but it did matter to an agent behind enemy lines. This might also explain why the book was in English. German soldiers signaling to one another would use a book in German, if they used a book at all. But a spy in British territory would need to carry a book in English. Van Damme examined the book more closely. The price had been written in pencil on the end paper, then rubbed out with an eraser. That might mean the book had been bought second-hand. Van Damme held it up to the light, trying to read the impression the pencil had made in the paper. He made out the number 50, followed by some letters. Was it EIC? It might be ERC. Or ESC. It was ESC, he realized. 50 escudos. The book had been bought in Portugal. Portugal was neutral territory, with both German and British embassies, and it was a hive of low-level espionage. As soon as he got back to Cairo, he would send a message to the Secret Intelligence Service station in Lisbon. They could check the English-language bookshops in Portugal. There could not be very many, and try to find out where the book had been bought, and, if possible, by whom. At least 2 copies would have been bought, and a bookseller might remember such a sale. The interesting question was, where was the other copy? Van Damme was pretty sure it was in Cairo, and he thought he knew who was using it. He decided he had better show his find to Lieutenant Colonel Bogg. He picked up the book and stepped out of the truck. Bogg was coming to find him. Van Damme stared at him. He was white-faced and angry to the point of hysteria. He came stomping across the dusty sand, a sheet of paper in his hand. Van Damme thought, what the devil has got into him? Bogg shouted, "What do you do all day, anyway?" Van Damme said nothing. Bogg handed him the sheet of paper. Van Damme looked at it. It was a coded radio signal with the decrypt written between the lines of code. It was timed at midnight on June 3rd. The sender used the call sign Sphinx. The message, after the usual preliminaries about signal strength, bore the heading Operation Aberdeen. Van Damme was thunderstruck. Operation Aberdeen had taken place on June 5th, and the Germans had received a signal about it on June 3rd. Van Damme said, "Jesus Christ Almighty, this is a disaster." "Of course it's a bloody disaster," Bog yelled. "It means Rommel is getting full details of our attacks before they bloody begin." Van Damme read the rest of the signal. Full details was right. The message named the brigades involved, the timing of various stages of the attack, and the overall strategy. "No wonder Rommel's winning," Van Damme muttered. "Don't make bloody jokes," Bog screamed. Jakes appeared at Van Damme's side, accompanied by a full colonel from the Australian brigade that had taken the hill, and said to Van Damme, "Excuse me, sir," Van Damme said abruptly. "Not now, Jakes."
"Stay here, Jakes," Bog countermanded. "This concerns you too."
Van Damme handed the sheet of paper to Jakes. Van Damme felt as if someone had struck him a physical blow. The information was so good that it had to have originated in GHQ. Jake said softly, "Bloody hell." Bog said,
"They must be getting this stuff from an English officer. You realize that, don't you?"
"Yes," Van Damme said.
"What do you mean, yes? Your job is personal security. This is your bloody responsibility."
"I realize that, sir."
"Do you also realize that a leak of this magnitude will have to be reported to the Commander-in-Chief?"
The Australian colonel, who did not appreciate the scale of the catastrophe, was embarrassed to see an officer getting a public dressing down. He said, "Let's save the recriminations for later, Bog. I doubt the thing is the fault of any one individual. Your first job is to discover the extent of the damage and make a preliminary report to your superiors." It was clear that Bog was not through ranting yet, but he was outranked. He suppressed his wrath with a visible effort and said,
"Right. Get on with it, Van Damme."
He stomped off, and the colonel went away in the other direction. Van Damme sat down on the step of the truck. He lit a cigarette with a shaking hand. The news seemed worse as it sunk in. Not only had Alex Wolf penetrated Cairo and evaded Van Damme's net, he had gained access to high-level secrets. Van Damme thought, "Who is this man?" In just a few days, he had selected his target, laid his groundwork, and then bribed, blackmailed, or corrupted the target into treachery. Who was the target? Who was giving Wolf the information? Literally hundreds of people had the information. The generals, their aides, the secretaries who typed written messages, the men who encoded radio messages, the officers who carried verbal messages, all intelligence staff, all inter-service liaison people. Somehow, Van Damme assumed, Wolf had found one among those hundreds of people who was prepared to betray his country for money or out of political conviction, or under pressure of blackmail. Of course it was possible that Wolf had nothing to do with it. But Van Damme thought that unlikely, for a traitor needed a channel of communication with the enemy, and Wolf had such a channel, and it was hard to believe there might be two like Wolf in Cairo. Jakes was standing beside Van Damme, looking dazed. Van Damme said, "Not only is this information getting through, but Rommel is using it. If you recall the fighting on 5 June." "Yes, I do," Jakes said. "It was a massacre." And it was my fault, Van Damme thought. Bog had been right about that. Van Damme's job was to stop secrets getting out, and when secrets got out, it was Van Damme's responsibility. One man could not win the war, but one man could lose it. Van Damme did not want to be that man. He stood up. "All right, Jakes. You heard what Bog said. Let's get on with it." Jakes snapped his fingers. "I forgot what I came to tell you. You're wanted on the field telephone. It's GHQ. Apparently, there's an Egyptian woman in your office asking for you, refusing to leave. She says she has an urgent message and she won't take no for an answer." Van Damme thought, "Elena." Maybe she had made contact with Wolf. She must have. Why else would she be desperate to speak to Van Damme? Van Damme ran to the command vehicle, with Jake's heart on his heels. The major in charge of communications handed him the phone. "Make it snappy, Van Damme. We're using that thing." Van Damme had swallowed enough abuse for one day. He snatched the phone, thrust his face into the major's face, and said loudly, "I'll use it as long as I need it." He turned his back on the major and spoke into the phone. "Yes?" "William?" "Elena." He wanted to tell her how good it was to hear her voice, but instead he said, "What happened?" "He came into the shop." "You saw him? Did you get his address?" "No, but I've got a date with him." "Well done." Van Damme was full of savage delight. He would catch the bastard now. "Where and when?" "Tomorrow night, 7:30, at the Oasis restaurant." Van Damme picked up a pencil and a scrap of paper. "Oasis restaurant, 7:30, he repeated. "I'll be there."
"Good."
"Elena."
"Yes?"
"I can't tell you how grateful I am. Thank you."
"Until tomorrow."
"Goodbye." Van Damme put down the phone. Bog was standing behind him with the major in charge of communications. Bog said, "What the devil do you mean by using the field telephone to make dates with your bloody girlfriends?" Van Damme gave him a sunny smile. "That wasn't a girlfriend. It was an informant," he said. "She's made contact with the spy. I expect to arrest him tomorrow night." Chapter 12. Wolf watched Sonia eat. The liver was underdone, pink and soft, just as she liked it. She ate with relish, as usual. He thought how alike the two of them were. In their work, they were competent, professional, and highly successful. They both lived in the shadows of childhood shocks. Her father's death, his mother's remarriage into an Arab family. Neither of them had ever come close to marrying, for they were too fond of themselves to love another person. What brought them together was not love, not even affection, but shared lusts. The most important thing in life for both of them was the indulgence of their appetites. They both knew that Wolf was taking a small but unnecessary risk by eating in a restaurant, and they both felt the risk was worth it, for life would hardly be worth living without good food. She finished her liver, and the waiter brought an ice cream dessert. She was always very hungry after performing at the Cha-Cha Club. It was not surprising. She used a great deal of energy in her act. But when finally she quit dancing, she would grow fat. Wolf imagined her in 20 years' time. She would have 3 chins and a vast bosom. Her hair would be brittle and graying. She would walk flat-footed and be breathless after climbing the stairs. "What are you smiling at?" Sonia said.
"I was picturing you as an old woman, wearing a shapeless black dress and a veil."
"I won't be like that. I shall be very rich and live in a palace surrounded by naked young men and women eager to gratify my slightest whim."
"What about you?"
Wolf smiled.
"I think I shall be Hitler's ambassador to Egypt and wear an SS uniform to the mosque."
"You'd have to take off your jackboots."
"Shall I visit you in your palace?"
"Yes, please, wearing your uniform."
"Would I have to take off my jackboots in your presence?"
"No, everything else, but not the boots." Wolf laughed. Sonia was in a rare gay mood. He called the waiter and asked for coffee, brandy, and the bill. He said to Sonia,
"There's some good news. I've been saving it. I think I've found another Fozzie."
She was suddenly very still, looking at him intently.
"Who is she?" she said quietly. "I went to the grocer's yesterday. Aristopoulos has his niece working with him."
"A shop girl?
She's a real beauty. She has a lovely, innocent face and a slightly wicked smile."
"How old?"
"Hard to say. Around 20, I think. She has such a girlish body."
Sonia licked her lips.
"And you think she will..."
"I think so.
She is dying to get away from Aristopoulos, and she practically threw herself at me."
"When?"
"I'm taking her to dinner tomorrow night."
"Will you bring her home?"
"Maybe. I have to feel her out. She's so perfect, I don't want to spoil everything by rushing her."
"You mean you want to have her first?"
"If necessary." Do you think she's a virgin?
It's possible.
If she is, then I'll save her for you. You were so good with Major Smith, you deserve a treat. Wolf sat back, studying Sonya. Her face was a mask of sexual greed as she anticipated the corruption of someone beautiful and innocent. Wolf sipped his brandy. A warm glow spread in his stomach. He felt good, full of food and wine, his mission going remarkably well, and a new sexual adventure in view. The bill came, and he paid it with English pound notes. It was a small restaurant, but a successful one. Ibrahim managed it, and his brother did the cooking. They had learned the trade in a French hotel in Tunisia, their home. And when their father died, they had sold the sheep and come to Cairo to seek their fortune. Ibrahim's philosophy was simple. They knew only French-Arab cuisine, so that was all they offered. They might perhaps have attracted more customers if the menu in the window had offered spaghetti bolognese or roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. But those customers would not have returned, and anyhow, Ibrahim had his pride. The formula worked. They were making a good living, more money than their father had ever seen. The war brought even more business, but wealth had not made Ibrahim careless. 2 days earlier, he had taken coffee with a friend who was a cashier at the Metropolitan Hotel. The friend had told him how the British Paymaster General had refused to exchange 4 of the English pound notes which had been passed in the hotel bar. The notes were counterfeit, according to the British. What was so unfair was that they had confiscated the money. This was not going to happen to Ibrahim. About half his customers were British, and many of them paid in sterling. Since he heard the news, he had been checking carefully every pound note before putting it into the till. His friend from the Metropolitan had told him how to spot the forgeries. It was typical of the British. They did not make a public announcement to help the businessmen of Cairo to avoid being cheated. They simply sat back and confiscated the dud notes. The businessmen of Cairo were used to this kind of treatment, and they stuck together. The grapevine worked well. When Ibrahim received the counterfeit notes from the tall European who was dining with the famous belly dancer, he was not sure what to do next. The notes were all crisp and new, and bore the identical fault. Ibrahim double-checked them against one of the good notes in his till. There was no doubt. Should he perhaps explain the matter quietly to the customer? The man might take offense, or at least pretend to, and he would probably leave without paying. His bill was a heavy one. He had taken the most expensive dishes, plus imported wine, and Ibrahim did not want to risk such a loss. He would call the police, he decided. They would prevent the customer running off, and might help persuade him to pay by check, or at least leave an IOU. But which police? The Egyptian police would probably argue that it was not their responsibility, take an hour to get here, and then require a bribe. The customer was presumably an Englishman. Why else would he have sterling? And was probably an officer, and it was British money that had been counterfeited. Ibrahim decided he would call the military. He went over to their table carrying the brandy bottle. He gave them a smile.
Monsieur, madame, I hope you have enjoyed your meal.
It was excellent, said the man. He talked like a British officer. Ibrahim turned to the woman.
It is an honor to serve the greatest dancer in the world.
She gave a regal nod. Ibrahim said,
I hope you will accept a glass of brandy with the compliments of the house.
Very kind, said the man. Ibrahim poured them more brandy and bowed away. That should keep them sitting still for a while longer, he thought. He left by the back door and went to the house of a neighbor who had a telephone. If I had a restaurant, Wolf thought, I would do things like that. The 2 glasses of brandy cost the proprietor very little in relation to Wolf's total bill, but the gesture was very effective in making the customer feel wanted. Wolf had often toyed with the idea of opening a restaurant, but it was a pipe dream. He knew there was too much hard work involved. Sonya also enjoyed the special attention. She was positively glowing under the combined influences of flattery and liquor. Tonight in bed, she would snore like a pig. The proprietor had disappeared for a few minutes, then returned.
Out of the corner of his eye, Wolf saw the man whispering to a waiter. He guessed they were talking about Sonia. Wolf felt a pang of jealousy. There were places in Cairo where, because of his good custom and lavish tips, he was known by name and welcomed like royalty. But he had thought it wise not to go to places where he would be recognized, not while the British were hunting him. Now he wondered whether he could afford to relax his vigilance a little more. Sonia yawned. It was time to put her to bed. Wolf waved to a waiter and said, "Please fetch Madame's wrap." The man went off, paused to mutter something to the proprietor, then continued on toward the cloakroom. An alarm bell sounded, faint and distant, somewhere in the back of Wolf's mind. He toyed with a spoon as he waited for Sonia's wrap. Sonia ate another petit four. The proprietor walked the length of the restaurant, went out of the front door, and came back in again. He approached their table and said, "May I get you a taxi?" Wolf looked at Sonia. She said, "I don't mind." Wolf said, "I'd like a breath of fresh air. Let's walk a little way, then hail one." "Okay." Wolf looked at the proprietor. "No taxi." "Very good, sir." The waiter brought Sonia's wrap. The proprietor kept looking at the door. Wolf heard another alarm bell, this one louder. He said to the proprietor, "Is something the matter?" The man looked very worried.
I must mention an extremely delicate problem, sir."
Wolf began to get irritated.
"Well, what is it, man? We want to go home."
There was the sound of a vehicle noisily drawing up outside the restaurant. Wolf took hold of the proprietor's lapels.
"What is going on here?"
"The money with which you paid your bill, sir, is not good."
"You don't accept sterling? Then why didn't—"
"It's not that, sir. The money is counterfeit."
The restaurant door burst open, and three military policemen marched in. Wolf stared at them, open-mouthed. It was all happening so quickly he couldn't catch his breath. Military police. Counterfeit money. He was suddenly afraid. He might go to jail. Those imbeciles in Berlin had given him forged notes. It was so stupid. He wanted to take Canaris by the throat and squeeze. He shook his head. There was no time to be angry now. He had to keep calm and try to slide out of this mess.
This ends side two of cassette four of The Key to Rebecca. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette five. Rebecca, cassette five.
The MPs marched up to the table. Two were British and the third was Australian. They wore heavy boots and steel helmets, and each of them had a small gun in a belt holster. One of the British said, "Is this the man?"
"Just a moment," Wolf said,
and was astonished at how cool and suave his voice sounded. "The proprietor has, this very minute, told me that my money is no good. I don't believe this. But I'm prepared to humor him, and I'm sure we can make some arrangement which will satisfy him." He gave the proprietor a reproachful look. It really wasn't necessary to call the police. The senior MP said, "It's an offense to pass forged money."
"Knowingly," Wolf said. "It is an offense knowingly to pass forged money."
As he listened to his own voice, quiet and persuasive, his confidence grew.
"Now then, what I propose is this. I have here my checkbook and some Egyptian money. I will write a check to cover my bill and use the Egyptian money for the tip. Tomorrow I will take the allegedly counterfeit notes to the British Paymaster General for examination, and if they really are forgeries, I will surrender them."
He smiled at the group surrounding him.
"I imagine that should satisfy everyone."
The proprietor said, "I would prefer if you could pay entirely in cash, sir." Wolf wanted to hit him in the face. Sonia said,
"I may have enough Egyptian money."
Wolf thought, "Thank God." Sonia opened her bag.
The senior MP said, "All the same, sir, I'm going to ask you to come with me." Wolf's heart sank again. "Why? We'll need to ask you some questions." "Fine, why don't you call on me tomorrow morning? You'll have to come with me. Those are my orders." "From whom?" "The assistant provost marshal." "Very well, then," said Wolf. He stood up. He could feel the fear pumping desperate strength into his arms. "But either you or the provost will be in very deep trouble in the morning." Then he picked up the table and threw it at the MP. He had planned and calculated the move in a couple of seconds. It was a small circular table of solid wood. Its edge struck the MP on the bridge of the nose, and as he fell back, the table landed on top of him. Table and MP were on Wolf's left. On his right was the proprietor. Sonia was opposite him, still sitting, and the other two MPs were on either side of her and slightly behind her. Wolf grabbed the proprietor and pushed him at one of the MPs. Then he jumped at the other MP, the Australian, and punched his face. He hoped to get past the two of them and run away. It did not work. The MPs were chosen for their size, belligerence, and brutality, and they were used to dealing with soldiers, desert-hardened and fighting drunk. The Australian took the punch and staggered back a pace, but he did not fall over. Wolf kicked him in the knee and punched his face again. Then the other MP, the second Englishman, pushed the proprietor out of the way and kicked Wolf's feet from under him. Wolf landed heavily. His chest and his cheek hit the tiled floor. His face stung. He was momentarily winded, and he saw stars. He was kicked again, in the side. The pain made him jerk convulsively and roll away from the blow. The MP jumped on him, beating him about the head. He struggled to push the man off. Someone else sat on Wolf's feet. Then Wolf saw, above him and behind the English MP on his chest, Sonia's face, twisted with rage. The thought flashed through his mind that she was remembering another beating that had been administered by British soldiers. Then he saw that she was raising, high in the air, the chair she had been sitting on. The MP on Wolf's chest glimpsed her, turned around, looked up, and raised his arms to ward off the blow. She brought the heavy chair down with all her might. A corner of the seat struck the MP's mouth, and he gave a shout of pain and anger as blood spurted from his lip. The Australian got off Wolf's feet and grabbed Sonia from behind, pinning her arms. Wolf flexed his body and threw off the wounded Englishman, then scrambled to his feet. He reached inside his shirt and whipped out his knife. The Australian threw Sonia aside, took a pace forward, saw the knife, and stopped. He and Wolf stared into each other's eyes for an instant. Wolf saw the other man's eyes flicker to one side, then the other, seeing his two partners lying on the floor. The Australian's hand went to his holster. Wolf turned and dashed for the door. One of his eyes was closing. He could not see well. The door was closed. He grabbed for the handle and missed. He felt like screaming. He found the handle and flung the door wide open. It hit the wall with a crash. A shot rang out. Van Damme drove the motorcycle through the streets at a dangerous speed. He had ripped the blackout mask off the headlight. Nobody in Cairo took the blackout seriously anyway, and he drove with his thumb on the horn. The streets were still busy, with taxis, gharis, army trucks, donkeys, and camels. The pavements were crowded, and the shops were bright with electric lights, oil lamps, and candles. Van Damme weaved recklessly through the traffic, ignoring the outraged hooting of the cars, the raised fists of the gharri drivers, and the blown whistle of an Egyptian policeman. The assistant provost marshal had called him at home. "Ah, Van Damme, wasn't you who sent up the balloon about this funny money? Because we've just had a call from a restaurant where a European is trying to pass..." "Where?" The APM gave him the address, and Van Damme ran out of the house. He skidded around a corner, dragging a heel in the dusty road for traction. It had occurred to him that, with so much counterfeit money in circulation, some of it must have got into the hands of other Europeans, and the man in the restaurant might well be an innocent victim. He hoped not. He wanted desperately to get his hands on Alex Wolf. Wolf had outwitted and humiliated him, and now, with his access to secrets and his direct line to Rommel, he threatened to bring about the fall of Egypt. But it was not just that. Van Damme was consumed with curiosity about Wolf. He wanted to see the man and touch him, to find out how he would move and speak. Was he clever or just lucky? Courageous or foolhardy? Determined or stubborn? Did he have a handsome face and a warm smile? or beady eyes and an oily grin. Would he fight or come quietly? Van Damme wanted to know. And most of all, Van Damme wanted to take him by the throat and drag him off to jail, chain him to the wall, and lock the door and throw away the key. He swerved to avoid a pothole, then opened the throttle and roared down a quiet street. The address was a little out of the city center, toward the old town. Van Damme was acquainted with the street, but not with the restaurant. He turned two more corners and almost hit an old man riding an ass with his wife walking along behind. He found the street he was looking for. It was narrow and dark, with high buildings on either side. At ground level, there were some shop fronts and some house entrances. Van Damme pulled up beside two small boys playing in the gutter and said the name of the restaurant. They pointed vaguely along the street. Van Damme cruised along, pausing to look wherever he noticed a lit window. He was halfway down the street when he heard the crack of a small firearm, slightly muffled, and the sound of glass shattering. His head jerked around toward the source of the noise. Light from a broken window glinted off shards of falling glass, and as he looked, a tall man ran out of a door into the street. It had to be Wolf. He ran in the opposite direction. Van Damme felt a surge of savagery. He twisted the throttle of the motorcycle and roared after the running man. As he passed the restaurant, an MP ran out and fired three shots. The fugitive's pace did not falter. Van Damme caught him in the beam of the headlight. He was running strongly, steadily, his arms and legs pumping rhythmically. When the light hit him, he glanced back over his shoulder without breaking his stride, and Van Damme glimpsed a hawk nose and a strong chin and a mustache above a mouth open and panting. Van Damme could have shot him, but officers at GHQ did not carry guns. The motorcycle gained fast. When they were almost level, Wolf suddenly turned a corner. Van Damme braked and went into a back-wheel skid, leaning the bike against the direction of the skid to keep his balance. He came to a stop, jerked upright, and shot forward again. He saw the back of Wolf disappear into a narrow alleyway. Without slowing down, Van Damme turned the corner and drove into the alley. The bike shot out into empty space. Van Damme's stomach turned over. The white cone of his headlight illuminated nothing. He thought he was falling into a pit. He gave an involuntary shout of fear. The back wheel hit something. The front wheel went down, down, then hit. The headlight showed a flight of steps. The bike bounced and landed again. Van Damme fought desperately to keep the front wheel straight. The bike descended the steps in a series of spine-jarring bumps, and with each bump, Van Damme was sure he would lose control and crash. He saw Wolf at the bottom of the stairs, still running. Van Damme reached the foot of the staircase and felt incredibly lucky. He saw Wolf turn another corner and followed. They were in a maze of alleyways. Wolf ran up a short flight of steps. Van Damme thought, Jesus, no. He had no choice. He accelerated and headed squarely for the steps. A moment before hitting the bottom step, he jerked the handlebars with all his might. The front wheel lifted. The bike hit the steps, bucked like a wild thing, and tried to throw him. He hung on grimly. The bike bumped crazily up. Van Damme fought it. He reached the top. He found himself in a long passage with high blank walls on either side. Wolf was still in front of him, still running. Van Damme thought he could catch him before Wolf reached the end of the passage. He shot forward. Wolf looked back over his shoulder, ran on, and looked again. His pace was flagging, Van Damme could see. His stride was no longer steady and rhythmic. His arms flew out to either side, and he ran raggedly. Glimpsing Wolf's face, Van Damme saw that it was taut with strain. Wolf put on a burst of speed, but it was not enough. Van Damme drew level, eased ahead, then braked sharply and twisted the handlebars. The back wheel skidded, and the front wheel hit the wall. Van Damme leaped off as the bike fell to the ground. Van Damme landed on his feet, facing Wolf. The smashed headlight threw a shaft of light into the darkness of the passage. There was no point in Wolf's turning and running the other way, for Van Damme was fresh and could easily catch him. Without pausing in his stride, Wolf jumped over the bike, his body passing through the pillar of light from the headlight like a knife slicing a flame, and crashed into Van Damme. Van Damme, still unsteady, stumbled backward and fell.
Wolf staggered and took another step forward. Van Damme reached out blindly in the dark, found Wolf's ankle, gripped, and yanked. Wolf crashed to the ground. The broken headlight gave a little light to the rest of the alley. The engine of the bike had cut out, and in the silence, Van Damme could hear Wolf's breathing, ragged and hoarse. He could smell him, too, a smell of booze and perspiration and fear. But he could not see his face. There was a split second when the two of them lay on the ground, one exhausted and the other momentarily stunned. Then they both scrambled to their feet. Van Damme jumped at Wolf, and they grappled. Wolf was strong. Van Damme tried to pin his arms, but he could not hold on to him. Suddenly he let go and threw a punch. It landed somewhere soft, and Wolf said, "Oof!" Van Damme punched again, this time aiming for the face, but Wolf dodged, and the fist hit empty space. Suddenly something in Wolf's hand glinted in the dim light. Van Damme thought, "A knife!" The blade flashed toward his throat. He jerked back reflexively. There was a searing pain all across his cheek. His hand flew to his face. He felt a gush of hot blood. Suddenly, the pain was unbearable. He pressed on the wound, and his fingers touched something hard. He realized he was feeling his own teeth, and that the knife had sliced right through the flesh of his cheek. And then he felt himself falling, and he heard Wolf running away. And everything turned black. Chapter 13. Wolf took a handkerchief from his trousers pocket and wiped the blood from the blade of the knife. He examined the blade in the dim light, then wiped it again. He walked along, polishing the thin steel vigorously. He stopped and thought, "What am I doing? It's clean already." He threw away the handkerchief and replaced the knife in the sheath under his arm. He emerged from the alley into the street, got his bearings, and headed for the old city. He imagined a prison cell. It was 6 feet long by 4 feet wide, and half of it was taken up by a bed. Beneath the bed was a chamber pot. The walls were of smooth gray stone. A small light bulb hung from the ceiling by a cord. In one end of the cell was a door. In the other end was a small square window set just above eye level. Through it he could see the bright blue sky. He imagined that he woke up in the morning and saw all this, and remembered that he had been here for a year, and he would be here for another 9 years. He used the chamber pot, then washed his hands in the tin bowl in the corner. There was no soap. A dish of cold porridge was pushed through the hatch in the door. He picked up the spoon and took a mouthful, but he was unable to swallow, for he was weeping. He shook his head to clear it of nightmare visions. He thought, "I got away, didn't I? I got away." He realized that some of the people on the street were staring at him as they passed. He saw a mirror in a shop window and examined himself in it. His hair was awry. One side of his face was bruised and swollen. His sleeve was ripped, and there was blood on his collar. He was still panting from the exertion of running and fighting. He thought, "I look dangerous." He walked on and turned at the next corner to take an indirect route which would avoid the main streets. Those imbeciles in Berlin had given him counterfeit money. No wonder they were so generous with it. They were printing it themselves. It was so foolish that Wolf wondered if it might be more than foolishness. The Abwehr was run by the military, not by the Nazi party. Its chief, Canaris, was not the staunchest of Hitler's supporters. "When I get back to Berlin, there will be such a purge." How had it caught up with him here in Cairo? He had been spending money fast. The forgeries had got into circulation. The banks had spotted the dud notes. No, not the banks, the paymaster general. Anyway, someone had begun to refuse the money, and word had got around Cairo. The proprietor of the restaurant had noticed that Wolf's money was fake and had called the military. Wolf grinned ruefully to himself when he recalled how flattered he had been by the proprietor's complimentary brandy. It had been no more than a ruse to keep him there until the MPs arrived. He thought about the man on the motorcycle. He must be a determined bastard to ride the bike around those alleys and up and down the steps. He had no gun, Wolf guessed. If he had, he would surely have used it. nor had he a tin hat. So, presumably, he was not an MP. Someone from intelligence, perhaps. Major Van Damme, even. Wolf hoped so. I cut the man, he thought. Quite badly, probably. I wonder where. The face? I hope it was Van Damme. He turned his mind to his immediate problem. They had Sonia. She would tell them she hardly knew Wolf. She would make up some story about a quick pickup in the Cha-Cha Club. They would not be able to hold her for long, because she was famous, a star, a kind of hero among the Egyptians, and to imprison her would cause a great deal of trouble. So they would let her go quite soon. However, she would have to give them her address, which meant that Wolf could not go back to the houseboat. Not yet. But he was exhausted, bruised, and disheveled. He had to clean himself up and get a few hours' rest, somewhere. He thought, I've been here before, wandering the city, tired and hunted, with nowhere to go. This time, he would have to fall back on Abdullah. He'd been heading for the old city, knowing all along, in the back of his mind, that Abdullah was all he had left. And now he found himself a few steps from the old thief's house. He ducked under an arch, went along a short, dark passage, and climbed a stone spiral staircase to Abdullah's home. Abdullah was sitting on the floor with another man. A nargala stood between them, and the air was full of the herbal smell of hashish. Abdullah looked up at Wolf and gave a slow, sleepy smile. He spoke in Arabic.
Here is my friend Ahmed, also called Alex. Welcome, Ahmed, Alex.
Wolf sat on the floor with them and greeted them in Arabic. Abdullah said,
My brother Yasef here would like to ask you a riddle, something that has been puzzling him and me for some hours now, ever since we started the Hubble Bubble, speaking of which...
He passed the pipe across, and Wolf took a lungful.
Yasef said, Ahmed Alex, friend of my brother, welcome. Tell me this, why do the British call us wags?
Yasef and Abdullah collapsed into giggles. Wolf realized they were heavily under the influence of hashish. They must have been smoking all evening. He drew on the pipe again and pushed it over to Yasef. It was strong stuff. Abdullah always had the best. Wolf said,
As it happens, I know the answer.
Egyptian men working on the Suez Canal were issued with special shirts to show that they had the right to be on British property. They were working on government service. So, on the backs of their shirts were printed the letters W-O-G-S. Yasef and Abdullah giggled all over again. Abdullah said,
My friend Ahmed Alex is clever. He is as clever as an Arab, almost, because he is almost an Arab. He is the only European who has ever got the better of me, Abdullah.
I believe this to be untrue, Wolf said, slipping into their stoned style of speech. I would never try to outwit my friend Abdullah, for who can cheat the devil? Yasef smiled and nodded his appreciation of this witticism. Abdullah said,
Listen, my brother, and I will tell you.
He frowned, collecting his doped thoughts.
Ahmed Alex asked me to steal something for him. That way I would take the risk and he would get the reward. Of course, he did not outwit me so simply. I stole the thing. It was a case. And of course, my intention was to take its contents for myself, since the thief is entitled to the proceeds of his crime, according to the laws of God. Therefore, I should have outwitted him, should I not?
Indeed, said Yasef. Although I do not recall the passage of Holy Scripture, which says that a thief is entitled to the proceeds of his crime, however...
Perhaps not, said Abdullah. Of what was I speaking?
Wolf, who was still more or less compos mentis, told him, You should have outwitted me because you opened the case yourself.
Indeed. But wait, there was nothing of value in the case. So Ahmed Alex had outwitted me. But wait, I made him pay me for rendering this service. Therefore, I got £100, and he got nothing.
Yasef frowned.
You, then, got the better of him. No. Abdullah shook his head sadly. He paid me in forged banknotes.
Yusuf stared at Abdullah. Abdullah stared back. They both burst out laughing. They slapped each other's shoulders, stamped their feet on the floor, and rolled around on the cushions, laughing until the tears came to their eyes. Wolf forced a smile. It was just the kind of funny story that appealed to Arab businessmen, with its chain of double crosses. Abdullah would be telling it for years. But it sent a chill through Wolf. So Abdullah, too, knew about the counterfeit notes. How many others did? Wolf felt as if the hunting pack had formed a circle around him, so that every way he ran, he came up against one of them, and the circle drew tighter every day. Abdullah seemed to notice Wolf's appearance for the first time. He immediately became very concerned.
What has happened to you? Have you been robbed?
He picked up a tiny silver bell and rang it. Almost immediately, a sleepy woman came in from the next room.
Get some hot water, Abdullah told her. Bathe my friend's wounds. Give him my European shirt. Bring a comb. Bring coffee. Quickly.
In a European house, Wolf would have protested at the women being roused after midnight to attend to him. But here, such a protest would have been very discourteous. The women existed to serve the men, and they would be neither surprised nor annoyed by Abdullah's peremptory demands. Wolf explained,
The British tried to arrest me, and I was obliged to fight with them before I could get away. Sadly, I think they may now know where I have been living, and this is a problem.
Ah!
Abdullah drew on the nargala and passed it around again. Wolf began to feel the effects of the hashish. He was relaxed, slow thinking, a little sleepy. Time slowed down. Two of Abdullah's wives fussed over him, bathing his face and combing his hair. He found their ministrations very pleasant indeed. Abdullah seemed to doze for a while, then he opened his eyes and said,
You must stay here. My house is yours. I will hide you from the British.
You are a true friend, Wolf said.
It was odd, he thought. He had planned to offer Abdullah money to hide him. Then Abdullah had revealed that he knew the money was no good, and Wolf had been wondering what else he could do. Now Abdullah was going to hide him for nothing. A true friend. What was odd was that Abdullah was not a true friend. There were no friends in Abdullah's world. There was the family, for whom he would do anything, and the rest, for whom he would do nothing. How have I earned this special treatment? Wolf thought sleepily. His alarm bell was sounding again. He forced himself to think. It was not easy after the hashish. Take it one step at a time, he told himself. Abdullah asks me to stay here. Why? Because I am in trouble. Because I am his friend. Because I have outwitted him. Because I have outwitted him. That story was not finished. Abdullah would want to add another double cross to the chain. How? By betraying Wolf to the British. That was it. As soon as Wolf fell asleep, Abdullah would send a message to Major Van Damme. Wolf would be picked up. The British would pay Abdullah for the information, and the story could be told to Abdullah's credit at last.
Damn!
A wife brought a white European shirt. Wolf stood up and took off his torn and bloody shirt. The wife averted her eyes from his bare chest.
Abdullah said, He doesn't need it yet. Give it to him in the morning.
Wolf took the shirt from the woman and put it on. Abdullah said,
Perhaps it would be undignified for you to sleep in the house of an Arab, my friend Ahmed.
Wolf said, The British have a proverb. He who sups with the devil must use a long spoon.
Abdullah grinned, showing his steel tooth. He knew that Wolf had guessed his plan.
Almost an Arab, he said.
Goodbye, my friends, said Wolf.
Until the next time, Abdullah replied.
Wolf went out into the cold night, wondering where he could go now. In the hospital, a nurse froze half of Van Damme's face with a local anesthetic. Then Dr. Abathnot stitched up his cheek with her long, sensitive clinical hands. she put on a protective dressing and secured it by a long strip of bandage tied around his head. "I must look like a toothache cartoon," he said. She looked grave. She did not have a big sense of humor. She said, "You won't be so chirpy when the anesthetic wears off. Your face is going to hurt badly. I'm going to give you a painkiller."
"No thanks," said Van Dam.
"Don't be a tough guy, Major," she said. "You'll regret it." He looked at her, in her white hospital coat and her flat-heeled shoes, and wondered how he had ever found her even faintly desirable. She was pleasant enough, even pretty, but she was also cold, superior, and antiseptic. Not like Elena. "A painkiller will send me to sleep," he told her. "And a jolly good thing, too," she said. "If you sleep, we can be sure the stitches will be undisturbed for a few hours."
"I'd love to, but I have some important work that won't wait."
"You can't work. You shouldn't really walk around. You should talk as little as possible. You're weak from loss of blood, and a wound like this is mentally as well as physically traumatic. In a few hours, you'll feel the backlash, and you'll be dizzy, nauseous, exhausted, and confused."
"I'll be worse if the Germans take Cairo," he said.
He stood up. Dr. Abathnot looked cross. Van Dam thought how well it suited her to be in a position to tell people what to do. She was not sure how to handle outright disobedience. "You're a silly boy," she said.
"No doubt. Can I eat?"
"No. Take glucose dissolved in warm water."
"I might try it in warm gin," he thought. He shook her hand. It was cold and dry.
Jakes was waiting outside the hospital with a car.
"I knew they wouldn't be able to keep you long, sir," he said. "Shall I drive you home?"
"No." Van Damme's watch had stopped. "What's the time?"
2:05.
"I presume Wolf wasn't dining alone."
"No, sir. His companion is under arrest at GHQ.
Drive me there.
If you're sure..."
"Yes." The car pulled away. Van Damme said, "Have you notified the hierarchy?"
"About this evening's events? No, sir."
"Good. Tomorrow will be soon enough."
Van Dam did not say what they both knew, that the department, already under a cloud for letting Wolf gather intelligence, would be in utter disgrace for letting him slip through their fingers. Van Dam said, "I presume Wolf's dinner date was a woman."
"Very much so, if I may say so, sir. A real dish. Name of Sonia."
"The dancer?"
"No less."
They drove on in silence. Wolf was a cool customer, Van Dam thought, to go out with the most famous belly dancer in Egypt in between stealing British military secrets. Well, he would not be so cool now. That was unfortunate in a way. Having been warned by this incident that the British were on to him, he would be more careful from now on. Never scare them, just catch them. They arrived at GHQ and got out of the car. Van Dam said, "What's been done with her since she arrived?"
"The no-treatment," Jake said. "A bare cell, no food, no drink, no questions."
"Good."
It was a pity, all the same, that she had been given time to collect her thoughts. Van Dam knew from prisoner of war interrogations that the best results were achieved immediately after the capture, when the prisoner was still frightened of being killed. Later on, when he had been herded here and there and given food and drink, he began to think of himself as a prisoner rather than as a soldier, and remembered that he had new rights and duties, and then he was better able to keep his mouth shut. Van Dam should have interviewed Sonia immediately after the fight in the restaurant. As that was not possible, the next best thing was for her to be kept in isolation and given no information until he arrived. Jakes led the way along a corridor to the interview room. Van Dam looked in through the Judas. It was a square room, without windows, but bright with electric light. There was a table, two upright chairs, and an ashtray. To one side was a doorless cubicle with a toilet. Sonia sat on one of the chairs facing the door. Jakes was right, Van Dam thought. She's a dish. However, she was by no means pretty. She was something of an Amazon, with her ripe, voluptuous body and strong, well-proportioned features. The young women in Egypt generally had a slender, leggy grace, like downy young deer. Sonia was more like... Van Dam frowned, then thought, a tigress. She wore a long gown of bright yellow, which was garish to Van Damme, but would be quite a la mode in the Cha-Cha Club. He watched her for a minute or two. She was sitting quite still, not fidgeting, not darting nervous glances around the bare cell, not smoking or biting her nails. He thought, she will be a tough nut to crack. Then the expression on her handsome face changed, and she stood up and began pacing up and down. And Van Damme thought, not so tough. He opened the door and went in. He sat down at the table without speaking. This left her standing, which was a psychological disadvantage for a woman. Score the first point to me, he thought. He heard Jakes come in behind him and close the door. He looked up at Sonia. Sit down. She stood gazing at him, and a slow smile spread across her face. She pointed at his bandages. Did he do that to you? She said. Score the second point to her. Sit down. Thank you. She sat. Who is he? Alex Wolfe, the man you tried to beat up tonight. And who is Alex Wolfe? A wealthy patron of the Cha-Cha Club. How long have you known him? She looked at her watch. 5 hours. What is your relationship with him? She shrugged. He was a date. How did you meet him? The usual way. After my act, a waiter brought a message inviting me to sit at Mr. Wolfe's table. Which one? Which table? Which waiter? I don't remember. Go on. Mr. Wolfe gave me a glass of champagne and asked me to have dinner with him. I accepted. We went to the restaurant. And you know the rest. Do you usually sit with members of the audience after your act? Yes, it's a custom. Do you usually go to dinner with them? Occasionally. Why did you accept this time? Mr. Wolfe seemed like an unusual sort of man. She looked at Van Damme's bandage again and grinned. He was an unusual sort of man. What is your full name? Sonia El Aram. Address? Shehan Zamalek. It's a houseboat. Age? How discourteous. Age. I refuse to answer. You're on dangerous ground. No, you are on dangerous ground. Suddenly she startled Van Damme by letting her feelings show, and he realized that all this time she had been suppressing a fury. She wagged a finger in his face. At least 10 people saw your uniformed bullies arrest me in the restaurant. By midday tomorrow, half of Cairo will know that the British have put Sonia in jail. If I don't appear at the Cha-Cha tomorrow night, there will be a riot. My people will burn the city. You'll have to bring troops back from the desert to deal with it. And if I leave here with a single bruise or scratch, I'll show it to the world on stage tomorrow night. And the result will be the same. No, mister. It isn't me who's on dangerous ground. Van Damme looked at her blankly throughout the tirade. Then he spoke as if she had said nothing extraordinary. He had to ignore what she said because she was right, and he could not deny it. Let's go over this again, he said mildly. You say you met Wolfe at the Cha-Cha. No, she interrupted. I won't go over it again. I'll cooperate with you, and I'll answer questions, but I will not be interrogated. She stood up, turned her chair around, and sat down with her back to Van Damme. Van Damme stared at the back of her head for a moment. She had well and truly outmaneuvered him. He was angry with himself for letting it happen, but his anger was mixed with a sneaking admiration for her, for the way she had done it. Abruptly, he got up and left the room. Jakes followed. Out in the corridor, Jakes said, "What do you think?" "We'll have to let her go." Jakes went to give instructions. While he waited, Van Damme thought about Sonia. He wondered from what source she had been drawing the strength to defy him. Whether her story was true or false, she should have been frightened, confused, intimidated, and, ultimately, compliant. It was true that her fame gave her some protection, but in threatening him with her fame, she ought to have been blustering, unsure, and a little desperate for an isolation cell normally frightened anyone, especially celebrities, because the sudden excommunication from the familiar glittering world made them wonder, even more than usually, whether that familiar glittering world could possibly be real. What gave her the strength? He ran over the conversation in his mind. The question she had balked at had been the one about her age. Clearly, her talent had enabled her to keep going past the age at which run-of-the-mill dancers retired. So perhaps she was living in fear of the passing years. No clues there. Otherwise, she had been calm, expressionless, and blank, except when she had smiled at his wound. Then, at the end, she had allowed herself to explode, but even then, she had used her fury. She had not been controlled by it. He called to mind her face as she had raged at him. What had he seen there? Not just anger, not fear. Then he had it. It had been hatred. She hated him. But he was nothing to her, nothing but a British officer. Therefore, she hated the British, and her hatred had given her strength. Suddenly, Van Damme was tired. He sat down heavily on a bench in the corridor. From where was he to draw strength? It was easy to be strong if you were insane, and in Sonia's hatred there had been a hint of something a little crazy. He had no such refuge. Calmly, rationally, he considered what was at stake. He imagined the Nazis marching into Cairo, the Gestapo in the streets, the Egyptian Jews herded into concentration camps, the fascist propaganda on the wireless. People like Sonia looked at Egypt under British rule and felt that the Nazis had already arrived. It was not true. But if one tried for a moment to see the British through Sonia's eyes, it had a certain plausibility. The Nazis said that Jews were subhuman, and the British said that blacks were like children. There was no freedom of the press in Germany, but there was none in Egypt either. And the British, like the Germans, had their political police. Before the war, Van Damme had sometimes heard Hitler's politics warmly endorsed in the officers' mess. They disliked him, not because he was a fascist, but because he had been a corporal in the army and a house painter in civilian life. There were brutes everywhere, and sometimes they got into power, and then you had to fight them. It was a more rational philosophy than Sonia's, but it just was not inspirational. The anesthetic in his face was wearing off. He could feel a sharp, clear line of pain across his cheek, like a new burn. He realized he also had a headache.